Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a conversation between Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter Roseanne Cash, author of Composed, and neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs. They'll discuss the topic Composing Identity. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 15, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Laura Burhan, founder of the Mina Birds.
As a musician with a great love of science, particularly the science of how music affects us on every level imaginable, emotional, physical, etc., I'm especially honored to present our guests tonight, Roseanne Cash and Dr. Daniel Levitin. First, Daniel Levitin is a cognitive psychologist, neuroscientist, record producer, musician, and writer. These are a favorite combination of left and right brain thinking, in my opinion. He has written on absolute pitch and music cognition and is widely known for his best-selling books, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, and The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. And I believe those are in the back there. He is currently a professor of behavioral neuroscience at McGill University. In his musical life, he has worked with Blue Oyster Cult, Chris Isaak, Joe Satriani, Steely Dan, Stevie Wonder, Santana, and The Grateful Dead, to name a few. Albums to which he has contributed have sold in excess of 30 million copies. And in line with my obsession about how small and interconnected the world is, my favorite wiki fact about Daniel is that he has an Erdos number of 4, and, as music advisor for the film Good Will Hunting, a Bacon number of 2. If you have no idea what that means, I apologize and highly recommend the New York podcast Radiolab, which is a great purveyor of stories where humanity and science meet, and which I can credit for my knowing what the hell an Erdos number is. Roseanne Cash is a Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter whose albums have topped both the country and pop charts over the span of her prolific career. Just last week, her latest album, The List, 12 songs selected from a list of 100 essential country songs her father, Johnny Cash, gave her when she was 18, was awarded the prize for Album of the Year at the Americana Awards. Her recently released memoir, Composed, showcases her as a poetic and insightful observer, incredibly deft with the written word and rich in revelation of her life experiences thus far. If you haven't already read it, I highly recommend it. And if you're a Twitter user, follow her now. Her daily insights are hilarious and give you a glimpse into the life of one of the busiest, fiercest, and most inspiring women in the business. I firmly believe that music is a power that allows us to connect to one another in a way that language cannot. Words point to meaning, but can't express it in the purest way that music can. As Roseanne succinctly said in an essay she wrote for the New York Times, we are so deeply limited by language and so ennobled by it. Songs are the attempt to convey what is under and behind language. So without further ado, I give the evening over to Roseanne and Daniel, who will get under and behind language, enlighten us with music, and better connect us one to another.
Good evening.
You brought the electricity out.
I'm really happy it started raining, actually. My brain can tell when a storm's coming, so it feels a lot better.
Is this a new development since your brain surgery?
Yes. What a nice segue.
Thank you.
I had brain surgery 2.5 years ago, and one of the after effects is that barometric pressure really affects me, and I can tell when a storm's coming. So I get a sense of relief when it finally starts raining.
We met in the 80s, and we were in touch for a while, and then our mutual careers went in different directions, and we got back in touch again after you had your brain surgery.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a good time to talk about it. Just jump right
sure.
in there. So
right.
Maybe you can describe, and I'll fill in.
The technical aspects?
Yeah.
Sure, okay.
Yeah.
It's
all family here.
Yeah, right. I had had headaches for a very long time, a decade, and they started getting worse. And I had a lot of other symptoms, too, that didn't make any sense, kind of brainstem symptoms and parasympathetic nervous system symptoms. And I was told I had migraines, and then I was told I had atypical migraines. Then I was told I had atypical migraines plus thunderclap headaches and possibly cluster headaches, and it just went on and on. And I got...
If I could just pause you here. Yeah. During this period of the headaches, and I guess you felt pressure in your brain,
yeah,
did this affect your songwriting or your musicianship at all?
Well, that's impossible to say. I can tell you in a second how it's changed since the surgery, but I'm not sure about
because
that.
Because some people who have migraines experience a kind of aura, right?
Yeah, I had aura, too, and I it was not pleasant. And I also had synesthesia, which is when your senses get crossed, where you... smell color. Or
if I could jump in here.
Please.
Well, I mean, you mentioned synesthesia, and I thought I could explain it
yes,
to our friends.
Yes, you can explain it better than I can.
No, not that. I just I wanted to have something to say.
How unusual.
Synesthesia is a neurological condition. It wouldn't be right to call it a disorder. Perhaps, because a lot of people have it. But it's where the senses are crossed, literally crossed in the brain. And, for example, someone who has synesthesia might smell a shape, or they might have the sense of color when they hear particular notes. Yeah. And they don't mean it metaphorically. It's not like they're saying...
Yeah, no, it's
that,
real.
Yeah. And we now believe that infants are all born this way. Their senses are completely crossed at birth. And for the first year of life, their brain undergoes some neurogenesis and changes that cause the senses to differentiate. But in perhaps one out of 200 people, the differentiation never occurs completely. And so you have people that when they smell a rose, they happen to feel something on their fingertips, or they hear a particular note on the guitar, and they don't just associate it with a color, they actually have color as an aura. And yes. So you got this synesthesia suddenly, as in a sudden onset.
I'm not sure it was sudden, because I'm not sure when I started noticing it, but it was before the surgery. And I remember particularly I had to have a lot of MRIs, and the MRIs are very loud, and it would invariably flood the chamber with orange for me when those frequencies. So anyway, I got kind of debilitated, and I changed neurologists, and he diagnosed within 2 weeks that I had a structural problem in my brain. It was as if my cerebellum, if your cerebellum is supposed to be in Montana, mine had gone down to Houston, and it was crushing my brainstem, which is why I was having all these other symptoms. So I had surgery November 27, 2007, and it was difficult. It was, my neurosurgeon told me to prepare myself psychologically because it was going to be difficult, and it really, really was. And the first year after was really difficult. And I couldn't stand to hear music with lyrics for several months afterwards. And in fact, I should go back and say my biggest fear, greater than my fear of dying, was that I would lose music, that I would either lose the ability to perceive it in the way that's so satisfying to me, or that I would lose the ability to compose it or perform it. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Oliver Sacks, as you are wont to do when you're about to go into surgery.
And you live in New York.
And I live in New York, and I had met him at a party, so I took advantage of that immediately. And I said, do you know what's going to happen to me musically after this surgery? And he said, well, my dear, your problem is with the cerebellum, and my specialty is with the cortex. So I can't really help you, but I do have an inkling how important this is to you. Which was great in itself.
It's a great New York story, too, right?
It's a great New York story. And there's also a good New York story. Quincy Jones had brain surgery. Great record producer. Many of you, I'm sure, know who he is.
And the writer of many of...
Writer of many, many great songs. And as he was going under, he said to the neurosurgeon, don't steal any tunes. So I used that as well with my neurosurgeon. Don't steal any tunes. The first year, was difficult lyrically. I didn't want to hear lyrics. And also, I kind of had the hearing of a dog in my left ear for a long time. So sound in general was difficult. Then it was as if somebody slowly in the second year had taken a veil off of music.
A long black veil?
Yes. Very good. Tada boom. And it was infinitely more precious and subtle, and the voicings were more subtle, and I was able to improvise more. I started performing again, and everything got better. And that's the only way I can explain it. It's as if a veil came off of it.
Now, as I understand it, you had a portion of your cerebellum was sticking down and pressing against the cerebral spinal fluid.
Yes.
Did they actually remove that portion of the cerebellum, or did they tuck it back up?
No. They did what's called a decompression, where they create space and hope the cerebellum goes back up where it belongs. Fortunately, mine did.
How do they create the space?
Oh, my God. They took out a portion of my skull. So I have a little Gore-Tex patch in the back of my head.
So you can withstand rain. At least in that one little spot.
You know, my morbid sense of humor is what got me through it. You know, I sang If I Only Had a Brain a lot. Walking into the operating room, I did.
The experience that you had is actually very timely and interesting, because until a few years ago, nobody knew that the cerebellum was involved in music.
I didn't know.
And your doctors probably didn't know.
No.
They probably told you, don't worry, it's the cerebellum.
No. My neurosurgeon actually said, I asked him about music, and he said, this is a question for a mystic.
I mean, not comforting words.
Well, except that I thought it was pretty humble for a neurosurgeon to say that.
Yes.
It was good. They're not usually so humble.
No, it's true. Well, the cerebellum's an interesting structure. It's Latin for little brain. And it's the part of the brain that all reptiles, all vertebrates have that. If they've got nothing else, they've got the cerebellum.
That's interesting, because every time I tune a guitar, I say I'm using my reptilian brain. That's all.
There you go.
Some basis in fact.
The reason it's been misunderstood is that the cerebellum is the part of the brain that Parkinson's patients are having trouble with, that and the basal ganglia, which are connected. The cerebellum is responsible, certainly, and this has been believed for hundreds of years, it's responsible for movement, and particularly for us Homo sapiens as bipedal organisms, we need to maintain a sense of balance, and our gait needs to be regulated so that we don't fall over. Two legs isn't nearly as stable as four. And in order to maintain your balance when you're walking or running, your gait needs to be steady. And the cerebellum is known to provide that steady gait. And for musicians, it provides a kind of an internal clock or counter. Have you ever played with a drummer who can always remember the exact tempo of the song and just...
Every night?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm hoping my drummer remembers the... Oh, you remain from night to night, remember the tempo of every song?
Yeah. Or you can say, I think we want to do this at 102 beats per minute, and they're right there.
That's interesting. I'm extremely sensitive to tempo, and if it's even a little bit off, it unsettles me.
Since the operation?
Always. But I was doing a show with Chris Christopherson, and I forget how it came up, and then he said, wow, you're really sensitive to tempo. And then he's kind of went, you're really sensitive to tempo. Like he didn't want to play
right,
with me.
Because
he has a very interesting sense of time.
Maybe he needs to have his cerebellum worked on.
You're just full of the rejoinders tonight, aren't you?
So the surgery caused you for a long period of time not to really have music in the normal way that you were accustomed to having it. So during that period, what did you do for a creative outlet?
I got out my second grade piano books, and I relearned all of the pieces in the elementary school piano books. And I didn't even realize why I was doing it until later, that I was retraining something to remind myself how to read music, just open up those pathways again. And It was also difficult to read a bit. You know, I liked being read too, but reading required a lot of concentration. So I played the piano a lot. And not guitar so much, which is interesting because that's my main instrument. But, you know, I really believe that somewhere in childhood you can seed your future creativity from childhood. I wrote about that in my book, actually, that you're always who you are, and all of those, the creative potential is there, and we start systematically shutting it down as we get older because things are too painful or we're too busy or there's too much work or our attention is elsewhere all the time. And so they start closing, but they're there and can be reopened, I think.
When you were, say, a little girl and in your teens, did you know or that you were going to become an artist, or did you just think it?
I knew there was something different that I wanted in my life. And I knew that I was different, that I didn't perceive things the way a lot of my friends did. When I was 12, I wrote my dad a letter describing to him my longing for the things I didn't know yet, my ambition for something I couldn't even articulate, my passion for something that felt just beyond my understanding. And he was the only one I told, the only one I trusted who would understand what I was talking about. And he wrote me back this great letter that said, basically, we are like souls. I'm so happy to know we are like souls. So that gave me courage to find out what it was that I was looking for. But
would you be willing to read the passage?
Well, yeah, it's not about that letter, but it is about what I was talking about seeding your future. This is just a couple of paragraphs. One day in 1990, after I had finished my album Interiors and was beginning to write the songs for The Wheel, I went to my file cabinet and aimlessly pulled out a folder of papers my mother had recently sent me of my artwork, homework, and spelling lists from the seventh grade. Leafing through them, I came upon an English project I had done on metaphors and similes. Reading the piece, I vividly remembered the excitement I had felt on being given this particular assignment, for it was the very first time in my entire career as a student that I had been excited about anything the nuns had ever asked me to do. I read through my discussion of metaphors and similes, and I could feel the thrill of my 12-year-old self coming off the page, a nascent writer in love with language, as if language were a potential lover. I came to a single page that said, in big letters I had printed very, very carefully, "A lonely road is a bodyguard." It was a metaphor I had invented, and I was pleased with myself for having chosen this powerful image over the more straightforward simile, "A lonely road is like a bodyguard." I lifted that sentence from my seventh grade project and put it directly into a song I was writing, "Sleeping in Paris." It goes, "I'll send the angels to watch over you tonight, and you send them right back to me. A lonely road is a bodyguard if we really want it to be." That song ended up on The Wheel, and whenever I hear it now, or think of it, or sing it, I nod to my little girl self, and she, in the wisdom of her great distance and perspective, looks on with pleasure and the patience of one who has waited a long time to be noticed. This one line and this one song is how I know who I am and how I know I survived. Thank you.
I was lucky enough to be able to read your book in galley form.
You gave me a blurb.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
And it's an extraordinary accomplishment and an extraordinary work of art and of insight. And as beautiful as that passage is, it wouldn't be fair to say that's the most beautiful passage in the book. The book is full of passages like that from the beginning to the end. It's a nonstop thrill, and I cried several times at the beauty of the way you express things, and at other times at just the sadness that you were able to put voice to.
Yeah, a lot of the book is about longing for art in the larger sense. And, you know, I said in the book too, you know, art has been my redemption. Art and music are religion to me. That if there is a higher power or an omniscient kind of force, then that is where art and music come from to me. And so there's something deeply spiritual about music and art and songwriting and performing, because it's connecting with that source.
If you had not gotten a record deal, if you had not become a successful, signed songwriter and artist, would you have continued to make music in obscurity, or would you have found another kind of artistic outlet?
Well, I mean, I would have continued to make music for myself, or
That's
with
what
my
I'm
family.
Asking,
yeah. Oh, sure. I may have had to find another way to make a living. But, yeah, I can't imagine a life without music. Then the whole world goes silent if there's no music.
You know, the Greeks used to say that one measure of the sophistication of a culture was by what percentage of time the average person spent engaged with art.
I love that.
And we think of the Greeks as a very scientific and artistic culture, and a political one. They had these three, they had balanced art in their best characterization of them. They had balanced art with scientific inquiry and with social responsibility, which is what politics was for them, making the world a better place.
Well, you know, if you're sensitive to art, you're going to have better social responsibility. It makes sense to me. And art and music have been so marginalized in school systems that it's so great to see a place like Kaneko and see these kind of programs happening around the country. It means everything.
There's been a kind of privatization of art in this country. And I find one of the things in our generation is that when we were growing up, there was music in the schools. Mm-hmm. Now there's not. But even when we had art and music education, there was a kind of judgment to it.
That,
you know, people would be told in my class, I remember the teacher saying to a couple of kids, don't sing, just mouth the words. Or we're going to do this collage project, and why don't you go to the library and
right.
do something
There's
else?
Right, there's a punitive sense about it. I remember a piano teacher who had a note on her piano that said, do not make up any songs you have written yourself. You know, just learn the book.
That's harsh.
That's harsh.
So
that would have been the end for me.
For people that don't have facility with art, that don't have musicianship or painting ability or poetic ability, what advice can you offer for how to incorporate art into everyday life?
But I didn't have facility or ability for it. I had instinct for it and passion, and I knew if I kept showing up that would lead me to what it was I was going to do, that I would develop an ambition for what I was going to do. And not only that, that once I found it, if I kept my head down and I kept showing up, no matter how hard it was, that I would get better at it and it would become comfortable. It took me 15, 20 years of being a performer before I ever really got comfortable on stage. What made me keep showing up? Because I knew that there was some miraculous transcendent gift, and I was gonna get to it. It just, you know.
You had to earn it, though.
I had to earn it. You know, who said that? There's a great saying that most people miss opportunity because it's dressed up in overalls and disguised as hard work. It's so true.
I had taken writing classes when I was younger, before I had written long before I had written my books. And one of the things I learned that was astonishing to me was that some of my favorite writers worked so hard at it.
So hard.
And, you know, we're both friends with Jill Kremenz, and her husband, Kurt Vonnegut, was always one of my favorite writers. And what I admired about Kurt was that when you read him, it just flows off the page so effortlessly. It looks as though it couldn't possibly have been planned. It just seems completely spontaneous. You really feel when you read Vonnegut like you're reading, you're on the front porch sitting with your drunk uncle who's just telling you stories and slurring his speech once in a while, but it's okay. But, you know, what Vonnegut has said in many, many interviews and what Jill confirms is that all of that spontaneity was planned and was arrived at through lots of hard work.
Absolutely.
And revision.
Somerset Maugham said, they said, asked him a question, they said, do you only write when you're inspired, or do you discipline yourself and write every day? And he said, oh, I only write when I'm inspired. Fortunately, inspiration strikes at 9 o'clock every morning. And I think that's what people miss, particularly, I used to teach a songwriting class, and a lot of young songwriters thought that if they got a line or a verse or a chorus with that great feeling of inspiration that sometimes just comes over you when you're in the zone, that that meant it was good. And I said, no, you just got something for free. Now you have to work.
Yeah, yeah.
To refine it,
yeah.
You know. I can't stress how important that is to keep showing up, keep working. I mean, it's so easy to say, well, I'll never be Bob Dylan, so why bother? But you're gonna.
I've heard people say that.
I've heard plenty of people. I've said it myself, you know. But then just get back up, do it again. Just keep doing it.
What I found with my own writing, and now now that I teach writing at the university, I found that usually it's not the case that young writers or novice writers don't have anything to say. It's that they have too much to say and they don't know where to start.
They don't know how to edit. Well,
right, yeah.
Editing is. It's difficult at first. I had a great songwriter friend, John Stewart, who said to me, write everything, edit later. Because if you bring in your editing too soon in the creative process, you get dismantled. It hurts your self-esteem. You can't finish it. You get discouraged. But if you put it all down and then refine and edit, you've got a better chance of getting something good. Should we do a song?
Yeah.
I think I'm talking too much. I'm better when I just, as they told the Dixie Chicks, shut up and sing. Somebody actually said that to me the other day. Seriously. I have a lot of wing nuts following me on Twitter. This is a song I wrote. I'll tell you a little about it, and Dan learned the guitar solo, which is really great.
Which song are we doing?
Dreams. Oh, that's funny.
I learned this one.
I was playing the Cambridge Folk Festival in 2003, and I climbed up to the top of a church with my daughter, and I looked out over the River Cam, and we were looking at it, and I had this odd vision that the water was coming up and that we were flying away. And I didn't just push it aside. I thought, that's such an interesting picture. And I started writing the song. And the song turned out to be about wanting to stay in the body, wanting to feel everything no matter how painful it was, just to stay on this earth. Because the temptation has always been for me to just go off somewhere, very dreamy and ungrounded. How would it feel to stay in the body and stay on the earth and feel everything? So it's interesting that my dad died a month after I wrote this song. So it was almost as if I knew it was coming and was telling myself, stay in the body. You'll get through it. The
Waves are breaking on the wall. The Queen of Roses spreads her arms to fly. She falls. If I had wings, I'd cut them down and live without these dreams so I could learn to love the ground. 'Cause I want to live inside the world. I want to act like a real girl. I want to know I'm not alone. The dreams are not my home. The future's like a ringing bell. The road to good intentions wanders all the way through hell. The note that hangs in the gilded hall, the clanging of my empty rooms. Yeah, I could learn to love them all. 'Cause I want to live inside the world. I want to act like a real girl. I want to know I'm not alone. And the dream do. The spires of churches are the last place to enjoy the view. If I had wings, I'd use them now. And I could follow you, then hope someone would pull me down. I want to live inside the world. I want to act like a real girl. I want to know I'm not alone. And the dreams are not my dreams, and not my dreams, and not my home. Dreams are not home.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, we haven't played this together before.
Clearly.
But what was fun for me is Roseanne emailed me and said, you know, I might want to do this song when we're together at Kaneko. And so I knew the song, but I never played it, and I got out the...
You learned it very well, actually.
Oh, thanks. Well, the thing that was fun for me was that the part is actually fun to play. I guess that your husband John wrote that guitar part.
No. Bill Bottrell wrote that part.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah.
So it's a whole interesting aspect of musicianship that people hardly ever talk about, which is the feel of things, that mm-hmm. some chord progressions or some notes are just feeling good to play. It feels good against your skin. It feels good with your muscles, and others are really don't feel good. And I often wondered, I'm not really much of a pianist, but I wondered if part of the attraction that so many pianists have to Chopin is that it feels good to do that stuff once you know how, or you've reached the level where you can.
Right. There's a kinesthetic pleasure out of actually making the chord changes.
Tactile.
Yeah, tactile. C goes very beautifully right into A minor on the guitar, and it does feel good. I mean, I think my challenge is to
go to areas where it doesn't feel normal and good and try to, you know, my growing edge is to find different chord changes and progressions.
I think another thing that people don't often think about is that to make music, you have to use your body and you have to move. The connection between movement and music is that in every instrument, you have to actually move in order, and you know, exert some muscle force in order to make something come out. Even the voice is a muscle.
Yeah. You know, I wrote about this in my book, too, about making records in the analog era, which was a very different experience than making records in the digital age. And making records then, I started making records in the late 70s, it was a very tactile, kinesthetic experience. It was like making a sculpture. You worked with tape and air. Air was a key component of recording back then. You know, it had created a sonic space. It wasn't like a bit on a computer. There was, you had to actually use air in the space. And you cut tape with a razor, and then you mixed by turning real knobs, and then you took it to a mastering lab where they made a mother piece of vinyl that was thick that they pressed all of these records from. You could actually scratch things into the vinyl if you wanted to. I mastered my second record 3 days after John Lennon died, and I had the engineer scratch Goodbye John into the Runout Groove. So the first 25,000 records have Goodbye John. So whenever anybody comes to a concert and wants me to sign a vinyl copy of 7 or 8, I look to see if it's there, and I've seen it 3 times, actually. But anyway, that feeling of really making a record, it was such a satisfying experience. And then things changed to digital, and the learning curve got very steep for me, and I lost that part of the experience. I had to become reinterested in making records digitally, because it was a totally different process.
It is very different. It not only feels different, but it sounds different.
Sounds different. Well, yeah. For somebody who's sensitive like yourself, yeah. It would sound very different.
And that's why you see people going back to analog, and they're now making more records. More vinyl records will be pressed in 2010 than were pressed in 2005.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's great, but they record them digitally still.
Not always.
And then press them onto, most of the time.
Yeah. But we were talking about showing up, and one thing I wanted to share was I had a student who was just completely blocked, and she said she would stare at the computer screen and she couldn't write, and this was going on for weeks. She just couldn't write. She didn't know what to write, and around that time I met a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Tim Page, who had just written a book about growing up with undiagnosed Asperger's syndrome. Mm. And he had been the former music critic at the Washington Post. He now teaches at USC. And he said that he had often faced this on deadline, this blank page or blank computer screen where he didn't know what to do. And an editor came in and gave him a piece of advice that he never forgot and that made a big impression on me, and then I passed it on to my student. It's almost never the case that you have nothing to say. You think you're staring and you don't know what to say, this editor said to Tim. What's really going on is you have too much to say and you're filtering it. You're blocking it. Mm. So instead of thinking, what am I going to write, just write the first thing that comes in your head. The editor said, you've got to write a piece about this Wagner Wagner concert last night. Write everything that comes in your head. Don't filter yourself. Even if you're writing, I can't stand this assignment, I don't know what to write, just get it started and write. And, you know, this chair is uncomfortable, and the coffee is lukewarm, and, you know, I forgot to turn off the burners at home, and, you know, why is my editor torturing me? But through that process, something will come.
I call that priming the pump.
Yeah.
I do that myself sometimes. I read a great book called The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield. Did anybody read that? It's a great book. And he talks about our resistance to art, to creating art, and to creating in general. And that as strong as our impulse is to create, that's how strong our impulse is not to resist it. And what you have to do to overcome that resistance, that you're always battling the resistance. I find myself doing it. I will eat everything in my kitchen to avoid writing that next chapter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's difficult, but you have to keep showing up. You have to keep sitting down in front of the page.
Go ahead. When you wrote your book, did you have a set place where you wrote it and a set time?
No, because I have children. I have a lot of children. So, I would write when they went to school and then in the evenings and sometimes on the road and wherever. But I like writing. I like writing when there's a lot of stuff going on around me. I don't like being shut up in a silent room. I think that is key, too, is finding who you are as a writer, as a musician, what serves you best, what environment. There's not just one way to do it.
For me, it always worked best if I made it a special time. First thing in the morning, before I've even gone down to breakfast or done anything else, I'll write until I run dry.
That's just good.
That morning fog isn't good for much else.
Yeah.
But for me, it's good for writing.
Well, that's the Somerset Maugham school of thought. Yeah. That's good. Do you want to do another song?
Yeah, I'd love to. And do you want to play one by yourself?
Sure. Maybe I will do What We Really Want. Do you remember how to play that, Dan? No?
No. I used to play that in a band. I love this song.
What We Really Want?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is from my record Interiors.
We tried to make ourselves pay for something we've never done. Threw the best parts of life away on street talk, strangers, and drugs. When what we really want is love. What we really need is love. I want to call out your name. I want to hold out my hand. The woman silent in the mirror tonight wants to talk to your mirror man. And what they really want is love. And what they really need is love. We are ships in the night. The water's deep in between. The air is freezing and we can't find the light, so we sail off into our dreams. And what we really dream is love, and what we really need, what we want is love. What we need is love. Tried to make it feel right in someone else's world. Sat and looked out my window last night and knew that things had changed for this girl. Cause what I really found is love, and what I really feel is love. And what we really want is love, and what we really need.
You know, people think of... I thought we might talk about a couple of things. One is goosebumps and one is experimenting. People think of scientists as being experimenters, tinkering with one thing or another, and of course that's what we do. But they probably don't realize how much experimentation goes into art, to creating a song, or even having written the song, experimenting with exactly the right way to deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a scientific process, isn't it?
Right, and a lot of it is guided by instinct, which I wouldn't imagine would be the case in science.
Oh, you'd or, be surprised. No, it is.
Maybe
you'd
it
be surprised.
Is, right. Okay.
I mean,
so it's very much the same then.
You know, the discoverers of the double helix of DNA, Watson and Crick, it came to one of them in a dream.
I remember that story.
Right?
That's right.
And there's a lot of intuition and a lot of just guesswork in science. You're faced with what you know, but in order to get from what we know to what we don't know, there really is a sort of creative leap that's required.
Right. You know, when I was writing my book in particular, I was constantly surprised about where what I was writing would take me without my knowledge. For instance, there's a scene I wrote about being at Oslo Prison and hearing this tribute concert to my dad shortly after he died at Oslo Prison. It was an amazing experience. I started writing about that, and suddenly I was put backward into a hardware store 5 years before this scene that I had no idea was connected in my subconscious to that those two things were connected. It was so satisfying. I got goosebumps when I started writing it, and it was as if it had been there all along, the destination, without me knowing it. And all I had to do was put myself in the place and just start doing it. And then it led me there. I mean, I know I've been quoting a lot of people, but E.L. Doctorow said writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as the headlights go, but you can get all the way home. It felt very much like that. It's such an incredible experience.
So physiologically, the only other time that people report goosebumps apart from, well, the two common times that people report them are when they're having a peak experience as a consumer of art. You see a painting that moves you, you hear music that moves you, you get this hair standing on end, the shivers down your spine. But the more common, of course, is when we're terribly afraid. And so the scientific question is, why would pleasure and fear be related in the way that they are?
If you figure that out, will you let me know?
Well, I have an idea.
Why?
I'd like to try it out.
Okay.
Well, usually fear comes from something that's unexpected, that at least that particular fear reaction. I mean, we can be afraid of things that we expect all the time. We're afraid that the tax bill's going to come. We know it's going to come and all of that. But the kind of fear that gives you the goosebumps and the shivers down the spine is usually something unexpected. And the reason it does that, it gives you that goosebumps, is that what's happening physiologically is you're having the fight or flight reaction. Your stomach stops digesting the food, the blood rushes to your extremities, and your body is ready either to fight. The reason your stomach stops digesting is because it needs to conserve the resources for what may happen. It does you no good to digest food if you're going to be dead in 10 minutes, right?
I'll remember that.
But your body knows it. You're either going to fight or you're going to run, and you need the blood in your feet and in your lungs to metabolize the running. So it's adaptive for that unexpected, fearful thing to cause this. I think what's going on when we have this reaction to art is that the artist does something that we didn't expect, and it's kind of thrilling.
Yeah.
And it's not fearful, but it's unexpected. And so our brain is tricked, as it were, into producing this reaction to unexpected things. And if you think about the songs that you like or the art that you like, I'm willing to bet in most cases the moment that gives you that, is when it takes a turn to a chord you didn't expect or a line you didn't expect.
And so why would, let's take something like Barber's Adagio for Strings, which is one of the most beautiful and sad pieces of music ever written. And I've heard it many, many, many times. And yet I have that same reaction every time. My hair stands on end and I tear up.
Well, I think...
Even though I know what to expect.
Yeah. Well, because... Although you know the piece and you know what to expect in that, it's still surprising compared to the thousands of other songs that you know. Barber's Adagio does some things that are what I would call schematically surprising. They go against the conventions of other songs. Another example is Yesterday by the Beatles. It has a 7-bar phrase. We're not used to 7-measure phrases. Usually phrases are 8 measures in most music we hear.
Right.
The first time you hear it, it's surprising. The 1,000th or 10,000th time you hear it, you know that what Yesterday's structure is, but it's so different from other songs that the part of your brain that's comparing it, not to itself, but to all the other songs you have a history with, that part is still surprised.
I think you're right, and I also think there's something undefinable in a truly great song or piece of music, that there is that element of mystery or connection to some source, something beyond us, that makes us feel alive.
I'm not claiming I'm accounting for the whole story. maybe this expectation thing accounts for a piece of it, and you're right. There's something magical and mysterious and ineffable about these kinds of artistic reveries, these artistic pleasures. And I think another part of it, and I have no explanation for why this should be, but when we hear an artist express true emotion, not fake, but true emotion, or when we get from a painting or a piece of sculpture, the emotion that the artist felt at the moment of creation, I think we're built, our brains are built to respond to that and to recognize it.
If she has the skill to transfer it, because, you know, toddlers have real emotions, and, you know, it's great, and I love a good toddler tantrum, but it doesn't move you to that kind of reverie, but...
There's that line, I tried to make it seem right in someone else's world.
That's that, my line.
I know, it gets me every time.
Aww.
It just sounds so sad.
It is sad. Sad is good.
Yeah.
Particularly if you put it into art.
But it's clear that that's a line that you lived and you felt. You didn't just pull it out of the ether.
No.
And I think if you want to talk about the biology of it, we're evolved to detect liars and cheaters. We're not perfect at it, but it would have been evolutionarily adaptive over tens of thousands of years of our development as a species to know when somebody is BSing us or when somebody's being sincere. And the fact is, it's a kind of an arms race in that we have a pretty good detector for cheaters and liars, but then there's always somebody who figures out how to perfect their lies, and so they can fool us for a little while, and then we improve our ability, and then a new crop of liars comes along.
And truth will out.
We hope.
Yeah. And that
maybe not in Washington.
No, eventually even there, I think. And then one truth doesn't fit all either.
Right.
And I also find that physical references, physical artifacts, furniture, the coffee cup that he threw across the room, the rain that was beating against the window, the door that was slammed, the chair, the table, that those things have emotional resonance, rather than just talking about the themes of love and loss, but the artifacts themselves have resonance.
Well, this is great writing, too. I mean, you don't write that he was angry. He wrote that he threw the coffee cup against the wall, or he threw my favorite coffee cup against the wall, or more poignantly, his favorite coffee cup against the wall, right?
I had a song I wrote, it's kind of an obscure song called Mirror Image, and there was a line in it that I taught myself about that very thing by writing this line. The line was, a cup of coffee and a dollar bill lay on the table like a fortune waiting for us to read. And the whole scene came alive for me when I wrote that, like, oh, he's leaving. You know, they're breaking up. But I didn't have to say that.
Right, right. You showed it. You didn't tell it.
Yeah. Should we do the song and then take question and answer?
Good idea.
Are we at that point?
Yeah.
Yes. Dan is being very generous. These are all my songs we're doing. He is a songwriter himself. I wrote this song when I was less than half as old as I am now.
You act like You were just born tonight, face down in a memory, but feeling all right. So who does your past belong to today? Baby, you don't say nothing when you're feeling this way. The girls in the bar singing, who is this guy? They don't think nothing when they're telling you lies. And you look so careless when they're shooting that bull. But you know heartaches are heroes when their pockets are full. You tell me you're trying to kill the seven-year ache and see what else your old heart can take. The boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon. Everybody's talking, but you don't hear a thing. But still uptown on your downhill swing. The boulevard's empty, why don't you come around? Baby, what is so great about sleeping downtown? There's plenty of dimes to be someone you're not. Just say you're looking for something you might have forgot. And don't bother calling to say you're leaving alone, cause there's a fool on every corner when you're trying to get home. Just tell her you're trying to kill the seven-year ache and see what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon. Tell me you're trying to kill the seven-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a conversation between Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter Roseanne Cash, author of Composed, and neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs. They have discussed the topic Composing Identity. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 15, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The next event in the Kaneko Great Minds series will be Friday evening, October 1st at 7:30 at the Kaneko Bow Truss, 11th and Jones. The guest speaker will be Josh Cooley, Pixar Animation Studios story artist and independent filmmaker. His topic will be coloring outside the lines and other creative ways to make people worry about you. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to Kaneko sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.